Today we're looking again at one of the old treasures. We've been walking through the certain highlights in the book of Genesis with a particular interest in Abraham and his family. And today we're back with Jacob. He's moved on from the place where he had the dream. If you were here last week, you'll know that we talked about that and kind of had some time in that particular episode. And now he's arrived in Haran, where his mother's family is from. And I think I mentioned last week it's about 550 miles. It's quite a trip to make. It would have taken him some time. It's a major journey, and it's possible that his arrival was the first they had seen of anyone connected to Rebekah's family since she had left many decades before. Jacob has come, if you remember, he's come to find a wife. That's a good reason, but there's even better reason than that, to flee his brother Esau, who had promised to kill him for stealing the birthright and stealing the blessing. And as Jacob comes, we meet Rachel and Leah, his cousins, and we also meet Jacob's uncle. I'm trying to keep all this straight, just trying to give you a little, so we can kind of flesh out the family tree a little bit. His uncle Laban is his mother's brother. Laban is the patriarch of this branch of the family. But it appears that certain qualities can travel throughout families. We've seen that in our own families, haven't we? Unexpectedly, a child will be born and you'll say, wow, he looks like Uncle so-and-so. Or as he grows up, she reminds me of Aunt, what, this person or that person. Laban is a lot like Jacob. Maybe Jacob's a lot like Laban. We see the family resemblance as he tricks and deceives him on his wedding night. And that's the story we have in front of us today. Now, we have to be careful with a narrative like this. In fact, any text, we have to be careful with it because the tendency just to pick it up and read it from our own world and our own context with our own values can lead us to very different conclusions than what the author has intended. You know, it's important to try to get at something of what's going on in the situation and how those hearing it for the first time would have reacted to it, as well as those who were a part of the story. What would they see and understand that we miss today? So the history of interpretation is important. It's not everything, of course, but it's a good idea, especially when reading texts that are so far removed from us, like this story in the Old Testament, to see what others have said, to see what the traditions have said about this, especially rabbinic traditions, since it's a Hebrew passage. I mean, we're not the first ones, after all, to take this up and read it today. So first, a few comments about what the tradition helps us to when we come to a story like this that's so different than what we might ordinarily expect to read. For one thing, let's just be honest, okay? This is a funny story. Does it strike you that way? It's humorous. Now, I know often we don't give ourselves permission to laugh at the things in the Bible that are humorous. But, you know, there are a lot of things in the Bible that are funny. Even things that Jesus said that were hilarious, jokes that he told, that now when we read it, it's like, oh, you know, it kind of has this stained glass aura around it. But it was hilarious in the original setting. Sometimes we don't permit the deep value of humor to be known and appreciated. See, people didn't go in a closet and read these stories. They were told. They were heard. They were public tales and stories of the patriarchs. And this description of the wedding night switcheroo would have been a gut buster. I mean, this would have been like one of the greatest jokes that the person could have told. And so, you know, we need to allow ourselves to see that. I was waiting for some of you to laugh because Debbie read it beautifully. She gave it just the right inflection, just the right sense of, okay. But I think we sometimes come at it and say, well, we need to be serious about it. I mean, obviously there's something serious, very serious in it. But when we think of the character of Jacob, who he is, what he's done, what he's already done to his brother, this passage is a bit of an ironic comeuppance, right? Gotcha. Secondly, in the history of this passage, there are the two sisters, Leah and Rachel. The NIV, which is that's the New International Version, that's what we have printed here in the bulletin each week. It says that Leah had weak eyes. Not too helpful. I mean, it's not really, poor gal. But the Hebrew can also mean she had tender eyes or she had soft eyes, which would have been an attractive feature, actually, in that culture. One rabbinic tradition holds that Leah had tender eyes and soft eyes because she actually had been betrothed to Esau, and that she didn't want to marry Esau, who was understood to be of questionable fidelity, and so she prayed to God with tears year after year to be set free from this obligation, and that God heard her and allowed her to marry Jacob. That's just tradition, okay? We're just looking at that. In the Christian medieval tradition, we also have Rachel and Leah that each represented a certain stream of piety. Rachel represented the contemplative life, the monastic life. Leah was the active or the non-monastic life. In fact, Dante, when he writes his visions of purgatory, includes Leah. He writes this: "In my dream, I seemed to see a woman both young and fair. Along a plain, she gathered flowers, and even as she sang, she said, 'Whoever asks my name, know that I'm Leah, and I apply my lovely hands to fashion a garland of the flowers I've gathered.'" Now, these traditions don't necessarily tell us anything definitive about the sisters, but they remind us that we're not starting from scratch. They remind us that people have pored over these stories for centuries. And when we come to a text, any kind of text, that others have thought about long before, we might want to be humble and spend a little time listening. Thirdly, it's just kind of an interpretive note, is to remind ourselves that this short passage that we have is actually part of three chapters that hold together. So it's a little odd to break it out and separate it. Three chapters that tell us of Jacob's time in Haran, in his mother's land. He's there 20 years. He's with Laban, he's with Leah and Rachel, and much is going on in that time. Most importantly, and I think it's the focus of the three chapters, is that they're having children. They're having children. Jacob cannot return to the land of promise without heirs. And the deception at the wedding is Laban's dirty trick, but it's also part of Jacob's larger journey home. It's particularly important to the provision of offspring, those who would become the leaders of the 12 tribes of Israel. So that's just a little background as we step in now to look at this. It's printed in your bulletin. If you have it in your Bibles, you can turn there from Genesis 29. What do we make of this deception? I mean, what are we to think of this? How do we understand it? Isn't that a pretty lousy trick to pull on someone? Doesn't Laban trample on the dignity of his daughters? Was God part of this deception? Is God a deceiver? Does God trick us? First, let's look at what Jacob requested and understand the nature of Jacob's request. Before we even get to Laban, what was Jacob doing? Here he comes out of the desert. No one knows him. He just shows up and he vouches for himself. They couldn't do a background check on him or anything like that. There'd been no contact. But he sits down with Laban and he tells the family story. And he knows enough of the details for Laban to say, "Ah, you're flesh of my flesh. You wouldn't know these things if you weren't my family." And he invites them to stay. And Jacob is there just a month. Just a month, he's working with Laban, and after a month, Laban says, I don't expect you to work for nothing. So tell me what you want. What are your wages? What would you like to be paid? And Jacob says, without hesitation, "I'll work for Rachel. Now, there's something about our society and our culture that values a person, that sets their sights on something and goes after it, right? We think that's pretty cool. But you know, in collectivist cultures, and there are plenty of cultures today like this, this kind of question, what would you want to be paid, would be answered with great care and negotiation and even deflection and indirectness. Look at Genesis 23. If you have a Bible, if not, I'll read to you a couple of things that show you really how this is done in this culture. Sarah has died, and Abraham is looking for a place to bury her. And he says, he speaks to the Hittites. He says, I'm a foreigner and a stranger among you. Sell me some property for a burial site so I can bury my dead. The Hittites replied to Abraham, Sir, listen to us. You're a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will refuse you his tomb for burying your dead. Then Abraham rose and bowed down before the people of the land, the Hittites. He said to them, If you are willing to let me bury my dead, then listen to me and intercede with Ephron, son of Zohar, on my behalf, so that he'll sell me the cave which belongs to him and is the end of his field. Ask him to sell it to me for the full price as a burial site among you. Ephron the Hittite was sitting among his people, and he replied to Abram in the hearing of all the Hittites who had come to the gate. No, my lord, he said, listen to me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. I give it to you in the presence of my people. Bury your dead. Again, Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephraim in their hearing, Listen to me, if you will. I will pay the price of the field. Accept it from me so I can bury my dead there. Ephraim answered Abraham, Listen to me, my lord. The land is worth 400 shekels, but what is that between me and you? Bury your dead. And then Abraham pays it. This is the way that negotiations are conducted in so much of the world, and the way they were done in this biblical culture, in this place where Abraham found himself. Sound familiar, Dan? What does Jacob do? I'll take Rachel. It's sort of like a king who wanted to honor a knight who had slain the dragon or something, and he says, I'll give you up to half of my kingdom. And the knight says, okay, I'll take half your kingdom. You see what Jacob's doing here? Jacob's being Jacob. Jacob is being Jacob. He doesn't understand the value of honor. He doesn't understand the value of respect. In fact, he dishonors his uncle in this request and the way it's made. He sets up a scenario that is slowly but surely backing Laban into a corner. We read this from our setting and we think, wow, Jacob really loves Rachel. He's not wasting any time. Good for him. But that's not how to read it at all. Frederick Buechner has written a book on a novel on the life of Jacob called Son of Laughter. And here's how he presents this interchange, this response. Tell me the wages I must pay, and I will pay them. Pay me Rachel, I said. Just Rachel is all the wages I ask. Laban jumped back as if a snake had fastened its teeth into his heel. Just Rachel? Rachel is all you're asking? You mean you don't want me to add the shirt off my back for good measure? You don't want me to also part with my good leg? I cleaned that part up, actually. With his hands on my shoulders, he held me off at arm's length as if to see better what manner of man he was bargaining with. He cocked his head. Jacob, Jacob, he said slowly. His voice was suddenly deep and full of sadness. He gave me a sorrowing smile. Be serious, Jacob. Do us both a kindness and be serious. Don't try to get the better of an old man just because he has taken you into his heart like a son. What was Laban's response? It's better that I give her to you than to some other man. Would you want your future and father-in-law to say that about you? I mean, that's high praise, right? Well, I guess you're better than the guy down the street. His whole life, Jacob had looked on the things that were not his, asked for things that were not his to ask for, and pursued through trickery and deception what he had no right to pursue. I guess in one sense, he's growing because he asked for Rachel directly and up front. There's no trickery here. But the answer's out of place. In this way, although he experiences a deep betrayal, he's not totally innocent. He plays some part in what Laban does in response. He's played into this. You know, just a little note of application on this. Sometimes we need to examine our own part in the pains, hurts, and betrayals that we face. Now, hear me carefully. Often, people are not to blame for what they experience. People experience violence and betrayal and injustice all the time that they had no part in. I want to note that. But it may also be valuable for us when we face things that don't make sense in our lives or personal hurts or betrayals or wrongs to say to ourselves prayerfully, did I have any part in that situation? If you're not sure, then it might be good to ask friends that you trust. Someone who will tell you the truth, not just take your side. What was my role, if any? And then be willing to seek to make it right. Cornelius Plantinga, who has written much on forgiveness, and we heard him speak earlier this year at Trinity on the topic of forgiveness, he said that understanding our own role in something can help to ease the sting of what we may have experienced from another person. It can help us to find the grace to forgive, knowing that situations are often complex and there may not just be one person to blame. Jacob is a person that seems to carry conflict with him. It followed him from his father's house. It will be with him in the 20 years that he's with Laban. He's tussled with everybody, trying to get the better of every other person in his path until he will finally wrestle with himself and with God. Yeah, he's tricked pretty diabolically, but he had some part to play in it. Secondly, I want to point out that there's some family similarities here. Like uncle, like nephew. Jacob has met his match, hasn't he, in a way? And the deception on his wedding night, as terrible as we see that, is related to Jacob's supplanting of Esau. It's part of challenging his character and his actions in the past. When he wakes up screaming with Leah, and I'm pretty sure that's what happened. Now that the light is there and he's sober, which were probably the two things that played into how it was able to take place anyway, it was dark and he was drunk. He rushes to Laban, and wouldn't we have liked to have heard that conversation? He protests. He's worked 7 years for Rachel. He's waited. He's toiled. He's courted her. And now what? Laban's response is more telling and more direct in the original. Not what we have here from the NIV, which introduces marriage into it. The original actually doesn't have that. Very simply, it says, it is not done in our place to set the younger before the elder. It's not done in our place to set the younger before the elder. And with those words, the wind is knocked out of him. He knows it. His past is catching up to him. The chickens are coming home to roost, whatever phrase you want to put in there. So much so that he offers no words of protest when Laban gives him a solution. He doesn't argue with Laban. His uncle says, finish out the week, the wedding week, then you can marry Rachel for an additional 7 years of work. And the text very simply says, and Jacob did. And Jacob did. No fancy words or arguments, no protestations. He knows he has met his match and that he's also facing himself. God is not in the deception. I want to say that. God did not cause this, but God can use it, and God will use it. Jacob needed to be found by God, not only in the dream and the ladder, but also in the daylight. God doesn't cause our troubles. Sometimes it's just selfish people or circumstances or terrible storms or whatever, or cancer cells. God doesn't cause these things, but God can use them and will use them. God has promised to be with Jacob, and he was with him here even when he was being deceived. Jacob came up against someone just like him. What happened to Jacob? Laban happened. Stuff happens, right? But God was with Jacob, and he was not done with him or his family, like uncle, like nephew. As we take this story forward, I think what we can draw encouragement from this is that God blesses Jacob in the days to come, in the years to come. God blesses Jacob. He blesses Leah. He blesses Rachel. He blesses Laban. He blesses Esau. God is not playing favorites. He's working to bring Jacob back to the land of promise and fulfill all of the good that he intended. It's complicated. Our lives also are complicated, but God is seeking to work out his purposes through us to bring us to the place of promise, just as he did for Jacob. Jacob is not stuck. The deception is not fatal, but it's part of his forward journey in God. There is a trajectory of hope and purpose for him and his whole family, of which we're a part. We're part of this family. Let me just pull one example out of the family story, because I think it's telling and I love it. Obviously, Leah was not honored in this. Was she? She wasn't. Her life also was often a misery, if you read the chapters going ahead, because she did not experience the love that she desired from her husband. God saw this and he didn't like it. So he blessed her with sons. 6 of the tribes of Israel are born to Leah. Rachel had children later, but not for a long time. See, Jacob had a favorite, but God did not. Jacob had a favorite, but God did not. When the Messiah is born, he comes of the line of King David, right? What tribe is David's tribe? Judah. Who was Judah's mother? Leah. I love that. God honored Leah in spite of all the pain she carried and the humiliation she endured and her rivalry with Rachel, because her part in the larger story is full of beauty and grace because of God, and the Messiah comes from her. The Lord orders the events of our lives even when we face setbacks and betrayals, and even when we've had a part in it, like Jacob. The psalmist tells us that it's God's judgments that prevail in all the world. St. Paul reminds the Christians in Rome that God is working out the events of their lives for good purpose, and that nothing can separate them from the love of God. You know, it can be hard to respond to the painful things in our lives that we don't understand. We wonder where God has gone, why God has abandoned us. I want to say with all pastoral care that God has not left you or me. And that even when we're having to face issues with our own character, even some problems maybe we caused, God is moving us along, forward, towards home, nudging us in the direction of redemption. There's a hymn that we don't sing. I don't know that we've sung it here. I love this hymn. I'll just read you one stanza of it. It was written in the 19th century, and it's actually a hymn for mission. It was a hymn sung over missionaries as they went out. This is the first stanza. God is working his purpose out. as year succeeds to year. God is working his purpose out, and the time is drawing nearer. Nearer and nearer draws the time when the earth shall be filled with the glory of God as the waters cover the sea. God was moving Jacob towards glory, and he's moving us in that same direction. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.